This is an interview with Mr. Ralph Powell, taken on the second day of December 1976 at the Christian Church in New Cumberland, West Virginia. Now, Mr. Powell, you were telling me about the pottery industry more or less being an adjunct to the clay industry here in Hancock County.
Markers in East Liverpool take it back to 1839, 1840, something like that. But there were two James Porters, and one was Big Jim and Little Jim. Big Jim was one of the entrepreneurs of the early clay industry here. And it was he who started the Chelsea Pottery. This was the large pottery down on the dismantled site that you can see now. He brought that in because of the clay that was here. Now, as far as New Cumberland area is concerned, this was an adjunct. Have you been in contact with the American Refractories Institute?
No.
When we first started the idea of this memorial to the clay industry, I tried to find the old American Clay Institute, but it's now the American Refractories Institute. It's in the it's in One Oliver Plaza, Pittsburgh. Mr. Bradford Tucker is executive secretary. He could probably steer you on this research as to whether something else has been done, something important has been done.
Okay.
But at any rate, when we determined that Mr. Joseph Gamble was excavating for a grist mill, for a new sluice for his grist mill down at Holbert's Run, he uncovered this clay, which he was astute enough to recognize as being high quality clay.
What year was this about?
This was about 1832. Mm-hmm. So he went back east and got some capital.
Now, this is a part that I haven't been able to nail down. This capital, there had to be capital.
That's
where
right.
Did it come from?
There is some disagreement as to who were the first families out. But there were the Andersons, the Freemans. Those were the first two. That's called Anderson. That was Freeman's Landing down there. It was also called at one time Anderson's Landing. See, each of these spots along the river was a private landing. But at any rate, the Freemans came out. They were early. The Andersons were early, and the Porters came along. He got them to set up a brickworks down at Mud Point, which is the mouth of Holbert's Run, where that auto repair shop.
Manfred's.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
His grist mill was a few hundred feet or yards, variously, up Holbert's Run.
Mm-hmm.
So, and within the, it's been into the 1950s that brickworks was finally dismantled. I mean, the kiln stood there up through the 30s and 40s. And it was operated early in the 40s for a brief time, as of the last time for the brickworks. But at any rate, this was the beginning. Now in 1830, the 1830 census shows from Kings Creek to Black's Island or above, there were less than 50 people. So there had to be people brought in. They soon used up all the men and boys available from the farms. On both sides of the river, by the way, because there was better communication when people had to go across on John boats and skiffs and rafts than there is today. Families, instead of a boy living in this block and his brother in another, they'd been this side of the river and on the other side of the river. So they used up all these people. Then it became necessary to have a town. The earliest town site was in the upper town here in New Cumberland. It was level, cleared, and closest that they could get. So they started the town of New Cumberland. Then started, then came the foundry, the carpenter shops, the blacksmiths, all the supporting industry. And this helped then to spread the industry up and down on both sides of the river. And what occurred on this side was duplicated on the Ohio side. Works. Now, there were never any clay works as such as outside the pottery within the confines of the town until you get into upper town. Now, the Clifton works up there, there are pictures in here, the Clifton works show, you recall where the old brickyard office was.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's surrounded by a surpipe works down this way, and then there were various types of company houses up there. There were brick apartment rows stood in among the storage yards and so on. In these booklets you will see they made all sorts of chimney caps, decorative flue liners, almost anything that could be made out of clay was made here. They would devote, in regard to the demand, they would devote more and more space in their shops. Now, their shops were quite large. They were all maybe 10 or a dozen times the size of your courthouse complex here.
Mm-hmm.
In these pictures, if you recall from our little history book, you had
right. That. Mm-hmm. I've already turned it in.
They have all just almost acre after acre of big shop buildings. Of course, this is where they're grinding. Leslie has told you about their grinding in the dry pans, the wet pans, and so on. Well, then they would devote little rooms in these shop buildings for these specialty manufacturers. And one of them was what I spoke to you about the other day, making stops. Two or three boys of my own age, 9, 10, 11 years old, went up occasionally to one of their surpipe works in Toronto. And they'd make these stoppers in these listings here, which were used to close one end of a double-ended surpipe. And you would get a half cent to a cent. For if it was a big 30-inch ones, you'd get a cent for it. And the smaller ones, I think down below 12 inches, were half a cent. And you could make maybe 15 or 20 cents a day by puttering around there. But everything in this area was built on clay. In the 60s and 70s and 80s, particularly. This was a heyday, and it was in the 70s that this area was referred to by the river pilots as Brickyard Bend. And they didn't refer to New Cumberland or Conger or anything, it was Brickyard Bend. There was, as an indication, in 1859, according to one of the old residenters here who had done some research, Mr. Fred Bradley, told me that in 1859, New Cumberland was the third port on the Ohio River in point of tonnage shipped. That's when you're competing with Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, and various others. Okay, this was because of the clay products. And this was one of the things that caused the growth in the size of the barges. The early barges were flatboats. The first ones they used to haul brick. Brick went down the river. Of course, there was no transportation here other than river and road until in the middle 1870s when the railroad came in. And there again, the dominant clay industry was the reason for the railroad coming in. We're back to the barges. When the brick first started, we'll go back to that. When the brick first started, from the first brickworks down at one point and various others, they shipped them on flatboats, and then they built barges, and there was a barge building works here in New Cumberland. The men would load their barges with a completed brick and then get aboard and float it down the river using poles and steering sweeps as best they could to their destination. After the embargo, or the tariff was adjusted in the 1840s in favor of American brick manufacturers, this eliminated the British monopoly. The British brought their bricks over as ballast in their vessels and hauled back American raw materials, such as cotton, tobacco, wheat, and so on. When Virginia politicians were able to get this adjusted, because this was still Virginia at that time, then the sugar planters, who were large brick purchasers in Louisiana, started to buy brick from people in this area. So these men then would float their flatboats or small barges down to New Orleans or Memphis or wherever they were going, sell the brick, sell the barge to be broken up with lumber, and then either walk or take whatever transportation they could back after the steamboats became more prevalent. And this was, of course, by the time that this was happening now in the 1840s and 50s, the great packets had begun to operate, and those who wanted to spend the money could come back on a packet boat. Some of them worked their way back as deckhands, some of them walked back. And of course, there were various railroads that they could use from time to time. The barges grew and grew in size as the output of the clay industry became greater. First it was bricks, then they started to make vitrified pipe, they started to make ornamental clay products, and they started to ship the clay itself. There were two plants in New Cumberland, in the New Cumberland area. One was the Chapman, the Acme manufacturing over here on the back road. The other was the West Virginia Fire Clay, which was down at the foot of Valentine's Hill, which sold only clay. It went out in carloads from Chapman's or by barge or rail from West Virginia manufacturing. The increasing bulk built up the size of the cargo and necessitated an increase in the size of the barges. At the same time, they were shipping coal down from Pittsburgh in barges. But because coal was not as heavy as the clay or brick, the clay barges had to be built, and brick barges had to be built larger. All in all, I've come to feel from the research that I did just on our little local history here that the clay, Gamble digging up that clay down there, gave impetus to the whole industrial surge in this section of the High Valley. Politically, this county, this area, was part of Ohio County until around 1800, 1798 to 1800, when Brook County separated from Ohio. And this then, at the inception of the clay industry, and up until 1848, was Brook County. And all records that we need prior to 1848, we still have to go to Willsburg for. But because of the business that was generated here, legal and financial, it was required that there be a seat of legal authority closer than Wellsburg, because they could go by boat or they could go by road if the roads were passable. And at best, it was always a long trip. New Manchester was an operating community at that time. I'm starting to early 1800, 1810, something of that sort. And because of the fact that they were older and just about as big as New Crumlin had become by middle 1840s, felt that that should be the seat of the government. That's treated, that's by play back and forth, it's treated in our middle history. But at any rate, the reason that they needed it was because of these, the people who came in here, the clay industry, the businesses, the supporting industries, and the refiners, that every type of industry, small industry that you could think of was here. I mean, this community was completely self-supporting, self-contained. All they needed from the outside was money. Of course, they brought in sugar, coffee, and staples like this, but they took care of themselves. There were three hotels, there were milliner shops, planing mills, carpenter shop, boat building yard, barge building yard, rather. All of them must have listed 35 or 40 various occupations. These are businesses in addition to the individual crafts that painters and so on have operated. So this then caused the need for the seat of government to be in this county, a new county, and the seat of government was established variously at the Crumlin of New Manchester. Economically, the area was changed from a strictly agricultural area in the 1830s to, up through the turn of the century, it was heavily industrial here. I mean, this was a booming and bustling community. This was increased in scope by the fact that there was an oil boom in the 1890s, early 1900s. Carson oil field, Turkey Foot oil field. This brought more people, more more families in. And they, of course, they dropped off people as they moved in and out. New Crumlin's population was around 3,000, I think, in around 1900, was its peak. It was probably one of the busiest towns of its size in this whole area. And there, and again, I keep going back to clay, because everybody worked in either clay or supporting industries. Now, after digging into this, and after we got our little book finished, I started talking to people in town, second and third generation. And almost invariably, their ancestors came here because either to work in clay or to operate a business or to work in an establishment that was here because the clay industry was here. Retail, service, or whatever. Clay brought most everybody, most of the families that were that are here. The we worked upon one aspect of the nationalities. The more the clay grew, the more men it needed. And they weren't able to get enough in this whole area. And branching out into, there were people coming down from Pittsburgh, coming from all over. They still had to go out farther, so they went back in the 90s and early 1900s into Western Europe and Central Europe. And they brought chiefly here Poles. Now on the other side of the river were Slovaks. But here they brought chiefly Poles. Up at Rocky Side was a Polish enclave. They had the first Catholic church here was a Polish mission church up there. There was a little school, of course. a lot of the families up there were Polish, and of course they were not, like Mr. Company has mentioned. His family lived up there in one of the double company houses. But there was a great wave of Polish immigration came in. Now there were a few other Austrian and slough box and so on, but they were chiefly poles. The services, I remember when I came to town, Father Olszewski, I could speak more easily with him in Polish than I could in English, because he was very limited. He didn't have to use English to a great extent. Then when the clay industry necessitated a railroad here, then the Italian families came in with the railroad. The pottery brought in the English. And these things all, you can trace them all back to a common source, clay. Everything that was done here from 1830 on was generated by the man turning over that vein of clay. And speaking of vein of clay, I went in one day to our chief engineer's office down here in Steele, and he had some baby food jars lined up on a shelf. And it looked like modeling clay. And I asked him if he was playing with that in his spare time. And he said, no. He said, when we were digging for the coal washer, now back on Ware Avenue, there's a coal washer near Dunbar School. He said they got down about 40 feet and they were into about a 15-foot vein of the finest mastic clay. Can't use it. Don't need it. Can't use it. But this is an example of the type of clay underlayment there is in this valley. This was domestic clay, is the finest clay that's used for China and so on. So there's a huge vein of it down there, which they had no interest in. I don't know what I'm skipping around here now. I don't know if there's anything that you'd like to bring out.
Well, you've touched a couple times on a topic that I haven't been able to get too much information on, and that is the capital that was required to do this boom building and so forth here. Are you familiar with where this came from?
No. In the history books that I have read, there are two things mentioned. One, that the Eastern Capital was required. And two, that Gamble got the Andersons and the Freemans and the Porters. Now, these were people, obviously, with whom he was familiar, that they had capital or had access to capital. And when they came out, then they were able to get these plants started. Now, whether they were local functionaries or whether they were the capitalists, I don't know. You probably have thought of exploring this, but the in the Secretary of State's office, the charter, incorporations and charters for these various businesses might give some clue, but they would be names only.
Mm-hmm. That it's so important as to where this capital came from.
This would have to be in the Secretary of State. This would be in Richmond.
That's
this
right.
Virginia at that
this
time.
Is Virginia.
Now there was, I can mention one that I'm more familiar with. These companies, these brick companies, and these clay companies. We finally had to decide upon one particular period when we would illustrate the complexity and the variety of clay companies, because they changed every year or two. There would be Anderson, Porter, and Smith. The next couple of years, it might be Anderson, Porter, and Kenny, or it might be Manypenny, Anderson, and Smith. They kept changing. I know my maternal grandfather had a farm down in back of Sistersville in the 70s and 80s, and he was sitting on top of an oil strike down there. So he finally sold out and came up here with his money and invested in a surfite works, and about 2 years it was gone. He was the kind of man who wouldn't sign a contract. He said, man's word is his bond. And when it came time to divide the proceeds, there weren't any for him. I mean, he wasn't legally entitled. But it was attracting, now this is one example of how money was attracted into this, was a growing operation here. And anything that was starting, there was always somebody available. If you've gone into financing in the middle 1800s, the canal system was a prime example. There was always money available, and I think that's when P.T. Barnum lived, when he said there's one born every minute. They would start a canal, it would fail, go bankrupt. Another company would be formed to take it over and finish it. That might fail, go bankrupt again. They get the same stockholders, they get the same investors two or three times. There was a good bit of money. Now, of course, there was English money. You know, it wasn't until around after World War I that we finally got rid of our great English debt, because most of the expansion that was done in this country was English money. And now, of course, it's going the other way, and American money is financing expansion. So, going back to your idea of capital, I don't know how much of this was basically English money that American bankers or promoters were using. The Secretary of State's records could develop something along this line. But the ownership, the partnerships changed. So if you recall, we published a list 1879.
Right.
Now, 5 years before and a few years after, there were very few of those that were the same. It seemed like there was always a Porter, there was always an Anderson, there was frequently a Smith or a Moneypenny. And then there other people came in, you know, with their 30 or 40,000 and got out for one reason or another.
Did you run into anything with regard to the effect of the Civil War on this? Now, we depended so heavily on river travel to get our product out, and of course the river was closed. The Mississippi was closed. Did that reflect back this way any then?
Tom, in the Civil War, if you watched Gone with the Wind and saw the amount of blockade running and so on, the Civil War didn't do much to impede business between the North and South. A lot of Southern cotton was sold in the North because the mill operators in the Northeast needed cotton, and they weren't going to let a war stand in the way of it. And there were ways left for them to obtain their cotton. By the same token, there was never any complete throttling of commerce on the Mississippi. Now, when Commodore Porter ran Island Number 10 and he ran Vicksburg, he had resistance because he was running gunboat fleets past. But there were and this is my impression from reading. Now, I've read extensively that Freeman and Cap and Dowdy, various others, that there was always a limited amount of traffic. This is you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. The local commanders knew that this was commerce. There was nobody trying to run any military supplies past, and they would let it go. So there wasn't a complete throttling. Now, to what extent this happened here? The war industry in the Northeast required more and more bricks. The furnaces that were built, the furnaces had to be repaired. You see the number of bricks that are going here for repair of the furnaces every day. The war industry, and there was a big arsenal in Pittsburgh. But the Arsenal District up there. Are you from this area originally?
Columbiana County.
Well, and you know, this the Northeast munitions industry required a lot of brick for their furnaces. Mm-hmm. And this was always my assumption, that instead of going south to the sugar planters, that they went on to the northeast. As far as incoming supplies were concerned, they were not dependent upon the south for anything. Mm-hmm. What reference I have run across was that business was spurred by the war, luckily, rather than being held back. Incidentally, one of the workers in New Cumberland contributed to one of the heroic episodes, the Great Train Robbery.
Oh?
And a Colonel James Andrews.
Mm-hmm.
In 1860, was listed as rooming in Hollandaise Cove at the census, and he was working in New Cumberland someplace. He went on to lead the, where they stole the locomotive general.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is one of these apocryphal things that you run into.
Right.
But,
I'm interested then also in the Chelsea or Cronin. I understand that Cronin bought Chelsea, right? So that same pottery can go by either name.
Right.
How did this one, or why? Maybe I'm not asking the right question, but you'll get my idea. What is this one China Works doing smack dab in the middle of a whole bunch of brickyards and vitrified pipe yards and all the rest of it?
Porter. This James Porter, the one referred to as Big Jim, was one of the more enterprising promoters. And it was he who established, or saw that was established, this giant pottery building in the Perry location.
Mm-hmm.
That was a huge building. It burned and was replaced by the one that those of us who go back into the 20s and 30s around here remember. This eventually also burned. The first building under the Chelsea China was first operated by Porter. I think he sold it. I'm not sure because I haven't gone into the pottery, but I think he sold it before it burned. It's not important. It wasn't important to our treatment. And I don't know at what point the Cronins took over the new building, but it was always referred to as Chelsea Pottery. In fact, the little road going down the hill there, you know, is Chelsea Hill. And the Cronins were here until they finally left and went to Sayo, where they started the Sayo Pottery. I'm sorry, Reese. Reese's went out there. They were in with the Cronins in this pottery down here.
Now, was that clay out of this same, or that?
They used local clay.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I was thinking about after we talked the other day, you mentioned the demise of the surpipe industry.
Mm-hmm.
My maternal relatives were chiefly all involved in surpipe. They worked in the plants in Toronto and were operating plants all Canada, South Carolina, all over. I remember I was in high school at the time when the business started to fade away. It was taken away originally by cement pipe, because I remember some very vivid denunciations of the cement pipe industry, and it at that time was up around Detroit. But they weren't selling surpipe because people were buying cement pipe. Now, of course, they've come to realize that cement pipe deteriorates more quickly than surpipe. In reading on archaeology, not long ago, one of the leading authorities said that if we want to leave any records, this is their time of time capsule, if we want to leave any records to leave our inscriptions on glazed surfite, glazed tile. They found records go back 10,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most durable. But this was one of the reasons for the decline in this area. They were losing business with the cement pipe manufacturers. Another was there was a major consolidation in the middle and late 20s. The American Vitrified Products Company bought most of the surfite plants. Now, at that time, there were no surfite plants on the West Virginia side of the river in the late 20s. They were all on the Ohio side. They were all brick on this side. They bought them and then started to move their operations after they consolidated, started to move some of their operations to various other newer and more efficient plants. And by the late 30s, these plants have been abandoned and almost completely dismantled as they are now. So this was, the plants had started to go before the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
I remember several people who were out of work really before the Depression hit. I mean, they were, the plants were still operating up into the early 30s, but on a reduced scale. I remember in 1929 or 30, when I was going to Toronto High School, and there was a lot of complaint within the school about the noise that the plants made, which were just located a couple blocks away. And it occurred to me a few years later that the problem was taken care of its own.
The noise was gone.
The noise was gone.
Mm-hmm. And the work was gone, too.
The work was gone. So I don't know, and this is something that you might be able to develop, but they, I think Tucker at the Refractors Institute could be helpful, but what the comparative weighted dollar sales of, or tonnage would be more realistic, comparative, say, 1925 shipments to 1970 shipments on vitrified pipe. This might indicate as to how much was made then as compared to what's being made now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because at that time, construction was very minor compared to the construction we see today. I mean, in driving up and down the Atlantic coast, the condominiums alone, when you think of the sewers that had to be constructed for those, we were driving just down one couple hundred mile stretch here a year or so ago, and we noticed, we became aware that there were just a glut of condominiums, so we started to count. Within about a 40 or 45 mile stretch, we counted 70 new condominiums, all under construction.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 1920s, there was nothing like this. So there wouldn't have been the need for the pipe then that there is now.
These very earliest families that came in were mostly of English stock, right?
Anglo-Saxon.
Anglo-Saxon, the German.
Anderson. Are you referring to the early capital that came in?
No, I'm just thinking. You said that you absorbed all the farm boys here, and then you brought in other help. That would be.
This was chiefly Anglo-Saxon.
Mm-hmm.
The German. Of course, the Germans flooded in here after the Revolution in 1848. The Germans came in over the whole Midwest section. You know, the South Side of Pittsburgh was German. Columbus, Cincinnati, were at one time almost half German. Ohio produced several solid German-speaking regiments in the Civil War. Their officers spoke English, but their men did not.
Mm-hmm.
The German in Wheeling. So there were Germans in this that came in, but the Anglo-Saxon. But as far as other than the Anglo-Saxon or Germanic, it wasn't until the brickyard started importing them, the clay industry started importing them, we got slops,
mm-hmm.
or Latins.
Now, were these people that were brought in this Polish way then, were they what we call contract labor, that somebody went to Poland and recruited and brought over, or had a company do it for them or something like
no,
that?
No, they, as far as I can determine, Tom, they did not do this in the sense that the Chinese coolies or the Irish were brought in for the railroads.
Mm-hmm.
They simply, and there must have been a tenuous, there had to be a promoter in there somewhere, that these brickyard operators, we needed men, and whether they went to the local consuls, or whether they, in other words, somebody knew that they needed men here, and they knew that there was a glut of people wanting to get across the ocean. But as far as I've ever been able to determine, nobody ever came in here on a contract basis. They came in a lot, well, simply like working for Arabs, specifically Yemenites, over for their meals. They brought two or three over, and then they started bringing everybody was related, everybody was from the same village, and so many of them had the same name that it was a complication for the payroll department. But this was the way. They'd bring over a few, and then they would bring back, they would send for
their brothers and cousins. And
yeah, I remember one man told me, he was an old man at the time I was talking with him. I was in retail groceries back in the late 20s, early 30s, and then you had to learn, in this area, you had to learn some of the other languages, you know, because what they called the greenhorns, just off the boat 10 or 12 years, they sent the kids to do their shopping. If the kids were sick or in school, then the old folks had to come in, and they had trouble. So you had to learn Polish, a little bit of Slavish. I never learned any Russian. But I spoke with one old fellow, and he had a younger, more attractive wife. And I said, how come you, an old fellow like you, a big walrus mustache, got a pretty young woman like this? He says, well, I come over here to work, I get some money, I write back, send me one wife.
And they sent him a young wife.
He said she was 15 years old.
Oh my.
But the point I'm trying to make is that this was a casual thing rather than a mass contract,
organized
such as we understand with the, well, today with the Puerto Ricans and the Jamaicans coming in for
apple pickers, for example.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Or for the Chinese that were brought in, and the Irish from the Western Railroad, the Irish for this railroad. In the early 1860s, when the Panhandle Railroad Bridge was being constructed, they had a large contingent of Irish laborers who were brought into the old country. And I recall reading in the old files that the good people of the north end of Steubenville took some axe handles and went up and worked them over, because they were coming down and defiling the better parts of town.
Oh.
They didn't want the Irish down there anyplace.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned just briefly, and I hope you can expand on it, there seemed to be a company town built up there, like you said, apartments, barracks, or something.
Well, they were in the pattern of company houses at that time. Up at Rocky Side, there were several double houses. On the housing.
Yes.
They built these double houses. In fact, Leslie has remarked from time to time some of the old pictures you saw, the ones that he did, and they were large houses. When I came here in the late 20s and early 30s, there were still some single houses built up there on the perched on the hillside. And they built houses every place. They had a number of the company houses up there. There were some private houses built back farther up on the hill. Now, down in town farther, there were several sections of a road type
mm-hmm.
company house that were rented a nominal rent to the employees. They were chiefly built out of brick. There were a couple of those just south of the old brickyard office. And there was one that, there was one frame type that was out on the riverbank farther.
How did the,
well, let's turn this over first.
How did the almost annual floods affect the clay industry right along here before the floods were brought under control?
Well, most of their machinery. Now, I was here for the 36th flood, but I heard a lot of talk about the earlier ones. There were middle-sized floods in the early 30s and the early 20s, going back to 1913 for the next big flood. And they didn't have the devastating effect because there wasn't the sophisticated machinery set up. I mean, brickyard machinery and clay machinery was well, not rudimentary, but it was stoutly constructed, not too complicated, not too sophisticated. Consisted of the pan, the grinding pans, screens, the presses, and the cutting, forming presses for the surpipe, and the cutting mechanism for the brick, where they made their, they come out with their massive, their moist clay. But their, and their power was steam power. So when a flood came up, and you have to remember, most of these places were in higher elevations. Now down along those south of New Cumberland, the Sligo and the Black Horse and those, would probably be hit more frequently than those north of town because that was a lower elevation. But they would not have had the problem. You, everything was large. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that the gears on a press and the press mechanism, the water comes up, they shut down the plant, they pull the fires and the boilers. If it's going to get up around the boilers, they wait till the water goes down, they go in and they clean out the mud and oil everything up good and they're back in business. It isn't like you have to send like you have to send all the motors to Westinghouse to be rewound. Yeah. And all this sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason I ask, Wade Campbell's father, I think it was, or grandfather, had the lumber yard here in town. And he talked about the as a little boy about the confusion that every spring would bring with its flood or threat of flood.
Right, their business was downtown. And the business downtown, I mean, they had to, this was a fact of life. I mean, came spring, you had to be ready for a flood. My wife's grandparents were here from the, well, my wife's maternal grandmother was born and raised in the county. Her grandfather came in the 80s. As a barber, because of the business here, he and his brother came into a barber shop, which operated, well, it was Carrie Swan's, operated until last year. They told a story about down in the building where the theater now is, that there was a Chinaman had a laundry, and the water started to come up the street one day, and he was out there busily sweeping, trying to keep it out of his store. But this, I mean, this was sort of a joke with them. But this was just one of the things that they accepted, and those folks had been there for 40, 50 or more years, wouldn't be even moving. It was only we younger ones who got out of the flood.
Mm-hmm. But as far as the clay industry itself was concerned, it was just a fact of life too, and they just sort of went with it?
It would not have been a contributing factor to the demise of the industry. As it was in the Duralloy plant up here. They had a fire and two floods and they got out.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the last fire left the building in the shape that you see it now.
Yeah.
Demolished. But the clay industry stayed in well from its inception, and in the 70s when it was the peak, from the 70s up through the there was the 84 flood and the 1907 flood, 1913 flood, those are the major ones, right, in 36. They stayed right through those. Department didn't let pot. It
wasn't until really after that that the industry started to really slack off.
That's right. World War One started to see it go down. In the there was a recession in the early 20s, 1921 panic. This may have tightened up some of the money that was necessary to keep them afloat. But up until World War One, they were still, in fact, up through the early days of the World War, they were just before World War One, they were still importing. A lot of these Polish families came in just before World War One.
Now, Mr. Cuppy mentioned in talking with him the efforts to import some Negro labor into this area. But in talking with other people, I find that this, either Mr. Cuppy knew a lot more about it than the other people did, or the other people just didn't notice it. Did you discover anything with regard to folks being brought up from Virginia and the South to work in this area?
No. No, the aspect of Negro labor didn't present itself in anything that I have researched.
Mm-hmm.
Probably because of the prejudice that underlaid everyone's daily life. I mean, we go back, these things are hard to explain to our children. We go back into a time when prejudice was inborn. You had no hatred, but the nigger, as was referred to, well, for instance, I've mentioned my daughter gets into some of these things once in a while. Why were things like that? I said, Carol, you cannot take those situations out of the context of their times. When I was a kid, I went to the store and I bought fireworks. I'd buy a half dozen nigger chasers. I mean, this is what you bought, nigger chasers. It was a little thing that squirreled. Well, they were used earlier to Negroes when they were more subservient and beat down. You could just set one of those down, and I never saw it done, but this was the name, and I heard some of the older folks say that this is what they did to frighten me. You know, somebody walking on the sidewalk, they threw one of those down. Slingshots were called nigger shooters. So, I mean, I'm only mentioning these because I think it demonstrates the attitude, the inborn attitude that was prevalent in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this would be a block to importing blacks, as long as people knew that they could import more Europeans, more people like those who were here, because, you know, one of your great sociological blocks, you don't want to have anything to do with anyone that's different.
Mm-hmm.
There were slaveholders, slaves in this county. I think the 1860 census showed 3. But I don't suppose there was ever an organized campaign or any conscious effort to block the importation of black. But just what was one of those things that wasn't done because nobody felt it was the thing to do.
And what was the attitude toward these Polish people then? They receive a more congenial reception, or did they have to stay in their part of town? Or?
Well, there again, going back, in the early teens and 20s, there was a resistance not nearly like there was with the Flash, but there was a resistance because these were people who were different. Their customs and their language, even their manner of dress was different. And you know, you can't be different. And here was a comfortable Anglo-Saxon society here that was very well satisfied with itself and with each other. And of course, you had the matter of religion. All of the Slavs who came in were Catholic. And up until that time, there was very little Catholic. There was no church. There was very little Catholic representation. So it was an enclave up in the Rocky Side area, and then into the north part of town. They moved down to the northern part of town. I think it was just a matter of, they live up there and we live down here, and everybody's satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there was never any, like in Steubenville, where they took their axe handles and went to work over the Irish labor camps. There was never anything as violent or as strong as that. It was a matter of, over the years, the Polish people sold themselves on the fact that they were good, moral, law-abiding, respectable people, and this became apparent to the earlier residents, and as a result then a good relationship developed.
Now, you mentioned that the population of New Cumberland at the turn of the century was 3,000. It's not that now. Where did our people go?
Well, Tom, one of the things that I mentioned, I looked around in church on Sundays just a couple of weeks ago, I commented, if we had all the good young people that we have trained, raised up and trained in our churches, we'd have a fine organization instead of a retirement block that you see every Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
In the first place, at that time, that was the time of the oil boom. There were a lot of families. Now my wife's paternal ancestors were Germans who came in. Their name was Foss. They came in from the Pennsylvania oil field of Titusville. Her paternal grandparents came over from Germany. Were Pennsylvania German, not Pennsylvania Dutch. They were in the Titusville oil field. They came down here in the 80s or 90s for this oil boom, the 90s. And then, as I say, dropped off people. My wife's father met and married my mother-in-law. He stayed here. His folks moved on to the Volcano oil field down in West Virginia, and then on into the Oklahoma strike, where they were when they died. I mention this because this is an example of the oil boom attracted people. And then when the oil boom died out, we lost them.
Mm-hmm.
And we lost more supporting industries. We lost the people who were in those industries and services. As these plants, they were cheap by jowl, as they closed down, they laid off men. They had to leave, find work elsewhere. So this was a major factor in population loss. And then, by the time we got down to where we're raising our families, the opportunities for young people, particularly young people with advanced education, were very limited here, so they had to leave this part of the country. We've got them all over the world right out of New Cumberland here. Fine young people who are contributing to their local community, wherever they are now. We can be proud of that, but we're sorry they're not doing it here.
Right. Did Wirt and Steel, as it grew and grew and mushroomed, did it absorb a lot of this leftover
this
labor?
This was a fortunate happenstance in that as these plants started to deteriorate and closed down, Wharton was needing more and more men. Now, Wharton, right up all up until the 40s, in fact, during the war, they were recruiting because the manpower loss had occurred. But they were bringing in people from all over the country. Up until the time of the Depression, to the middle 30s, and then they resumed again after business picked up just before World War II. So this was any number of men who have retired from Wharton Steel now. You talk to them and they started to work on the brick yards or clay works.
Mm-hmm. Moved on into the mill and have since retired.
So this was, I'll say, this was fortunate that Wharton was growing at the time clay was diminishing.
There's one point that I've asked several people. Only one person was even able to shed any light on it. You've talked about this mastic clay roll that the fellows down at Wharton Steel discovered in their test borings, and we know that there's still a lot of clay back here in the original veins. Is there any research and development body for the clay industry, any place that might be looking for ways to use this raw product to, well, I guess what I'm trying to say, could there ever be another clay boom in the sense that
I see what you're aiming at. If there does exist such an entity, Tucker, the Refractories Institute, okay, would be your man who would know that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll pursue it then with him. That's a good lead there. I hadn't didn't know that that existed. American Refractories Institute.
That's in, I forget the room number, but the building, you know, the one Oliver Plaza building,
mm-hmm,
this is the building in which they're located.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to him when we first came up with the idea of this memorial to the clay industry, wanting their participation, not necessarily financial support, but to give their corporate support to this, and I think he said they're very happy to do it. Of course, we ran into some very unfortunate circumstances here. One man lost all the papers. It cost us about 4 or 5 months. Another man forgot to make a key move. It cost us another 3 months. Instead of having it this year, it'll be next spring sometime,
mm-hmm,
which won't be. I mean, there's not that much harm done, but it was essentially a bicentennial memorial. Mm-hmm.
Are you coming out with some sort of a pamphlet or booklet or dossier or something?
No.
To go with that?
No. What we have now being cast in Detroit is a 2-foot bronze plaque memorializing this industry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be put on a site opposite the senior center uptown.
Mm-hmm.
And it will rise there.
Mm-hmm.
I held out, Leslie Cuffy and I held out for the library lot. I know that's a good location up there, but our point was maintenance. It's sad to see something like that put up and then in a year overgrown.
Yeah.
So I'm just sort of not disassociated myself, but I don't want anything to do with that location up there because I think it's wrong. But anyhow, there will be a reproduction of a kill, a frontal elevation of a kill with the stacks and the opening and so on. And this bronze plaque will be set in the midst of that. There'll be all this little clearing around there, brick paved.
Mm-hmm.
It should be attractive.
So it's a bee or a periodic or a beehive kill that you're talking about?
Beehive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, the beehive kill. Mickey Boyles, I don't know if you know the Boyles family. They have been another one of these families associated with the brick industry. He's the third generation now. I contacted him early in this idea of a memorial to the clay industry, with the idea of building this front elevation of the kiln.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he wants to build a small-scale kiln. He said, you don't realize what a strange thing we have here, how unique it is. He went over with his brother over into New Jersey to build a kiln, or some kilns on a kiln building job, and hired local bricklayers, as they're required to by the union. And they got the wall built and started to build the crown, and then the local bricklayers left. I'm not going to work on that, it won't work.
They couldn't put the crown in it.
Couldn't put it in. So he had to come back here and get some more relatives and bricklayers that worked in the brick industry, and went over and put it up. Well, the bricklayers made such a fuss about it in their local union hall in New York that a couple of New York newspapers came out and took pictures and an article on, you know, this can't be, you know, like a farmer saw a zebra in the zoo, he says, there ain't no such animal. They said, this can't be. They'd never heard of anything like this over there. Well, there was a Japanese industrial delegation in the East at the time. They saw it and they contacted him, wanted him to come to Japan to build some of these kilns. He said, you don't realize what we've taken for granted here all our lives, but it would cost all about $15,000 to build one, like an 8-foot kiln, mm-hmm. 8-foot high. And he said, and I agree with him, it's right, it should be. He said, young people can walk in and see what it's like. You can lay up some brick, have to pass them in, but show them this what it's like. Mm-hmm. This is what made this area.
Right.
But what we're going to have is just an elliptical or semicircular curved front with the outline. Mm-hmm. It'll represent a kiln. Mm-hmm. It'll be a start.
In talking to some production people in this project, I'm discovering that the beehive is on its way out, that the tunnel kiln is continuous fire kiln is
right. That's most efficient.
A new thing.
Now, incidentally, as far as I can determine, the first one of those, again, was done at Mud Point. In its last years, there was a tunnel kiln built down there. I know it was an innovation, because I know some of the people, relatives and so on, were interested in going over to see that. You know, it won't work.
Mm-hmm. Approximately what year would that have been?
Late 20s, early 30s now. I had no point of relation mm-hmm. to what year might have been.
Now that's very interesting because in talking to these production people, you know, they're boosting this as a new discovery, as something that just dropped out of heaven the last few years.
No, there was a tunnel kiln. Check this with Leslie.
Okay.
There was a tunnel kiln down at Mud Point. I'm trying to think of the name of the man who operated that works at last, whether he was the one or not. Whether he was the one who put it in or whether it had been installed before he took it over. Leslie's knowledge is phenomenal.
Sure is.
His recall. This is one of the things that we were fortunate in this history book. I had two people to work with, Miss Virginia Marshall and Leslie. They not only have good recall, but in their younger days, they were observant, they were intelligently observant to things that went on around them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a pleasure. All I had to do was bring together these things, you know. And if it hadn't been for them, we wouldn't have knew it. But,
you know. I haven't been able to get a hold of Miss Marshall.
She has been away, and yeah. She has been ill.
Has she returned yet?
Or? Yeah, she's home now.
Okay, I'll try some more.
She was in Huntington most of the, I think, week or 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
Now she, because of her father was one of the leading lawyers and political life here for a great many years. And she was aware of a lot of the business and legal and political aspects as we discussed mm-hmm. before, so she may be able to lead you into some things there that you will need to know.
Now, one more thing that I'd like to get on the tape, at least one more thing. You had mentioned chimney tops and novelty items that went along with the industry.
Yeah, this doesn't have the novelty, the clay lions and cats, doorstops and so on, although they were made in these plants, as I say, as a sideline. Because they had the clay product, all they needed was a mold, and then they fired them right in with the other products. But here's all sorts of
blue liners and the whole bit.
Now this book here is falling apart. I don't know. I think maybe the best solution for this is to pierce it and put ring binders on. I don't think it would be worthwhile to have it rebound. These, along with some other material that was turned over to me when we were compiling our book, I'm going to give to the library.
The Swaney Library?
Yes.
Here. Okay.
See, I was on the original library board, and we started a local history section that hasn't been pursued recently. But Leslie said that they're going to pick up someplace for all.
That ought to be almost in a rare book collection, not out where all kids could.
I went down there not long ago, and there's one book, Life and Times of Peter Gist, who was one of the men who guided Washington. So a little book was given to us, and it was just out. I suggested to Judy that she put it away because somebody put that in her pocket. I know it's jealously regarded by a lot of historians. There's a copy in Somerville, a man by the name of Dr. Schilling. I don't know if you ever heard of him. He was county health commissioner in Jefferson County for a long time. He lived out in New Somerset. Has written did write before his death, a couple of local histories. And when our librarian put in the local papers, Stibnall paper, a notice of this gift of this little book, he called me. I had gone to him and asked for his guidance in setting up our local history bookshelf. He called me and wanted to know if he could look at it. I said, well, you certainly are welcome to, because you've been so cooperative. He said, well, there's a rascal in Stibnall who's got one of those, and he wants to charge me $5 to look at one page.
Oh, my.
But it was this book that Dr. Schilling was able to establish that there really was a blockhouse up at Yellow Creek.
Mm-hmm.
See, I remember when I was young, we could say, well, people would say, well, there's a blockhouse. There used to be a blockhouse here, but nobody knew just where. But Schilling was able to pinpoint it. In fact, he found a roster of the militia assigned to it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is straying.
Yeah.